So let's be more general, and let's write out just the most general possible metric that I can think of without imposing any condition on scalar, vector, tensor, anything, right? So now in general, for the shift term, I can just have an arbitrary three component thing here. And then I can still, so then here we have, what do I want to call it? We'll call it gamma ij. So I just have some arbitrary 3x3 tensor.
We're imagining
here.
That's
but it has to be symmetric.
Delta plus, that's one plus some fluctuation.
Yeah, so this would be, sure, yeah, let's write it as that. So delta ij plus gamma ij, where now gamma ij would just include the fluctuating pieces. Okay, so this one is fine. That's a scalar. This one, now we can decompose that bi into, as Dan just mentioned, the divergence of a scalar plus some DJ B, I don't know, we'll give it a different name, lowercase b, k or something like that, where this is just a divergenceless vector.
And it's just like the Helmholtz theorem or something? Is it just a thing you can do with vectors?
Yeah, sure, okay. Absolutely. So that's a totally general statement.
Right.
That's really just an arbitrary decomposition.
Okay.
Yeah. And that has something to do with the properties under rotation, so it does have something to do with helicity if I go to momentum space.
Okay.
But you know, that's just a general thing I could do in real space. I could make this decomposition. Okay, so that takes care of this thing, and so I get this. Here we've got one scalar degree of freedom, and two things that we'd associate with the vector degrees of freedom.
And why are those vectors?
Why are they vectors? So because if I asked, so how do I call them vectors? That actually comes in the solicity argument. So if I asked, how do these, if I go to momentum space, how do these transform under rotations? Then I'd find that they transform like a vector. Or I guess just more generally, like, okay, here is a vector, okay, right? If I ask how that changes under general coordinate transformations, it's going to transform like a vector. This is a scalar function, so if I asked how that transformed under general coordinate transformations, it would transform like a scalar function. So then there's this gamma ij. Now we could think about how can we possibly decompose that gamma ij. So the first thing that I can always do is let's get rid of the brackets. The 2 is just for convention. I could define this thing which is just a diagonal piece, right? And that's sort of related to the trace of gamma ij. It's not exactly the trace, but it's related to the trace. So let's keep that. So this is like the trace. And that, of course, is a scalar. Manifestly, it's a scalar function. And now I've got this other piece. So I've got a eij. And in this EIJ, now I can decompose this thing into the scalar piece. And again, this, I guess, is a statement of the Helmholtz theorem, but now we're talking about a rank 2 tensor instead of just a vector field, right? So in general, I could have this. I could have what we call HIJ. That's the transverse traceless piece. And it's a little bit easier to see how to project that out in momentum space. And you'll forgive me, I can't remember the right projection operator, but you can project out the transverse traceless piece in momentum space. And then I could, in general, have, I could define another vector. So here I could have di, for lack of a better thing to call it, we'll call it v, vj plus dj vi. Right. And so there I have some other vector degrees of freedom. And because there's some constraint on this, in here I only really have, again, there's one constraint, and in here I only really have two vector degrees of freedom. Okay, so that's two vectors, that makes the four vector degrees of freedom as advertised in the beginning. I've got one scalar, two scalar, three scalar, four scalar, that's the four scalar degrees of freedom. And then for the transverse traceless piece, there's two polarizations in there, the plus and the cross, so that's the two tensor degrees of freedom.
So this is essentially the most general way of writing down any vector, scalar, and tensor.
Yeah, this is just the most general way of writing down a metric that looks like Robertson Walker plus something. No deeper than that. Now one thing though, I haven't made any assumption about all these functions being small. So at this level, they could all be whatever they are. I'm just writing a metric plus another metric, right? And no assumption in there about how small they are. And without that assumption about how small they are, if I stuck this into Einstein's equations, you'd find that all of these things were like coupled,
right,
and there'd be some nasty nonlinear relation between all these different items. It's only in the approximation that I make all of these metric functions small that they end up decoupling.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of the bigger picture. But yeah, if you want to stay afterwards,
yeah,
we can talk about it some more. Okay. So let's, any other questions from the tutorial I should ask? And I'm also happy to stay afterwards if there are. Okay, if not, then let's continue with what we did last time. So we had discussed all these different gauges, this most general way of writing down the metric, and the different ways you can specialize, and then you spend a few hours playing around with that. So now we're just going to forget about all of these possibilities, and we're going to focus. Okay, so we're going to focus on, for a few lectures, this conformal Newtonian gauge. So in the conformal Newtonian gauge, we've got a scale factor times negative 1 plus 2 psi, 1 plus 2 phi. Okay, so we have some metric function. And of course, where we're going is solving Einstein's equations for this metric. So in order to solve Einstein's equations, I need a right-hand side. So I need to make some assumption about the energy momentum tensor. And that's something we wrote down yesterday as well. So the energy momentum tensor, if we write it in this upper lower form, for a perfect fluid, looks something like this. And here, I'm simplifying a few things. So for example, let's assume that P is equal to W rho, and the background quantity is rho bar. Okay, so that's the background energy density. There was a mistake in what I wrote down last time. There should actually be a minus sign down here in this I0 component. Sorry for that. Okay, so we've got P is W rho bar, and we're writing rho, the total density, as rho bar times 1 plus delta. So delta is the density contrast. So if I plug these two things into the energy momentum tensor, and I also looked at the perturbations in the four velocity, which are encapsulated in these VIs. So these are the first, we'd call just these the peculiar velocities. And I expand it out to first order, I'd get this energy momentum tensor right here. So now we've got a metric, we've got an energy momentum tensor, so now I can plug this into Einstein's equations. And of course, Einstein's equations are terrible, nonlinear nastiness, and we're going to again make the assumption that things are small. So we're going to linearize Einstein's equations so that we can get something that we can work with. So we've got g mu nu is 8 pi times g newton t mu nu, and we're going to expand this. We're going to expand Einstein's equations. So we'll have a zeroth order piece, that's just Robertson Walker, plus some first order piece. And that's going to equal 8 pi g newton times t mu nu, the zeroth order piece, plus 8 pi g newton times a first order piece, which we'll call delta. So these two. First order. And as we do when we linearize any equation, we set the zeroth order pieces equal, and we set the first order pieces equal, and we solve those equations separately. And the zeroth order just gives us, of course, the Friedmann equations. And the first order will give us two independent equations. So the first order will give us two independent equations. It's not so bad to derive these yourself. I will spare you that lengthy exercise here, but I encourage you to do that on your own if you want practice. Alternatively, there exist many very nice packages for Mathematica, for example, where you can just plug things in and it will expand things for you to linear order. So either doing it the painful way or doing it the easy way, you will find that two independent equations result, and they look as follows. So that's the first one. And the second one is di dj. So these are just range over the spatial indices. I guess I didn't mention that, but my convention, as always and forever forward, will be that lowercase English letters are the three spatial directions, and the Greek letters are all four. Okay, so we have these two equations. Now, this one is really nice. So we have this equals zero. And that was actually something that came from our assumption, of course, about the energy momentum tensor. So this is just the off-diagonal components of the Einstein equation, the linear part of the Einstein equation. And that equals zero part was really, so this is just for perfect fluids. And in order to get it to not be zero, what we need a delta T I J not equals zero for I not equals J. Okay, so you can see that for perfect fluids, in the spatial part of the energy momentum tensor, we don't have any off-diagonal components. And that's really why this was zero. Now, having a delta Tij not equal zero is called anisotropic stress. And in the real universe, there are forms of anisotropic stress. For fluids that are not necessarily perfect, okay, so here we made this assumption. I'll just put a little note here. Universe is not perfect. We all have imperfections, even the universe. And the main sources of anisotropic stress in our universe are photon electron scattering, so Compton scattering, that induces anisotropic stress. And the other thing is something called free streaming. So it turns out that the perfect fluid approximation doesn't really hold for relativistic particles on all length scales. If I go below a certain length scale, I actually need to solve the Boltzmann equations and figure out the velocity distribution in more detail. And we know that there are nearly massless particles in our universe called neutrinos. And on small scales, I actually need to worry about that. So both scattering and neutrinos cause anisotropic stress.
Professor, wouldn't that equation not being equal to zero imply that gravity acts differently on relativistic and non-relativistic things?
Yeah, and that's right.
Okay.
Okay, so we have these two equations, at least for a perfect fluid. So let's run with that. So what is a perfect fluid? So here, we ruled out photons, we ruled out neutrinos. There's only really two perfect fluids in our universe, anyway, that we know of, and that is dark matter and baryons after they become neutral. So I have to wait until after the electrons and the protons find each other. Yes?
Is that supposed to be a Laplacian?
Yeah, that is supposed to be a Laplacian. Thanks very much. Okay, so for the next few minutes, we're going to assume that we're really only talking about these things here. So these are the only things that this set of equations really makes sense for. The first one's always okay. The second one only in the approximation that I have dark matter and baryons. Okay, so next what we need to do . So we solved Einstein's equations, but we still don't have an equation of motion for these perturbations in the matter sector. Okay. So in order to get an equation of motion for those, at least for these two items, dark matter and baryons after decoupling, I need to solve conservation of the stress tensors. So that is given by this equation, and this is going to give equations of motion for delta and the velocities. So one of your homework problems is to do this for real. So to solve the conservation of stress energy to find one of these equations. So I will leave that to you to do. And just quote the answer. So for the density perturbation, here's what you get. So that's one equation. And for the velocity perturbation, here's what you get. And for generality, I won't impose this condition that I get from the second Einstein equation. Not yet. Okay, so we get these two equations for the density fluctuations and the velocity perturbations. So now I'm just going to sort of massage these equations a little bit into a form that is most useful. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to, as always, go to Fourier space. By the way, I hope it's clear why we always go to Fourier space, right? That's a consequence of linearity, right? So whenever I have a linear set of equations, then as you learned in the tutorial, all the Fourier modes decouple. So I can turn a PDE, these are partial differential equations, into a tower of ordinary differential equations. And ODEs are easier to solve than PDEs, so that's why we do that. So as always, we go to Fourier space. And that means we're going to take all of these gradient operators and turn them into IK. So sticking that in, we get the time derivative delta plus I KI VI is negative 3 times the time derivative of phi. And then the time derivative of VI, nothing happens to the second term, but the thing on the right-hand side now becomes negative I KI times psi. Okay, so that's massaging step number one. And step number two we're going to assume that we only talk about irrotational components of the velocity. So what does that mean? That means that VI is going to be the magnitude of k in the ith direction times a scalar quantity v. And you can show that this is equivalent to saying that the velocity field has no curl. So it's only got a divergence piece. It can be written purely as the divergence of a scalar quantity. So what is a velocity here that has a curl? Of course, this is like a vorticity. Okay, so this would be some kind of toilet bowl flow. And the reason that we neglect it is that you can see in the equation of motion for the density perturbations, I have a divergence, and so the vorticity doesn't contribute to the density fluctuations, to the growth of density fluctuations. So that's why we forget about it. Okay, so if we make this assumption, then my two equations that I have written over here become following. So we have the time derivative of delta plus I times KI dotted into KI over K times velocity, the scalar, and that equals negative 3 d tau phi. So here this just becomes K squared, so I get K squared over K, that gives me K. And then for the second equation, we can expand this out. I've got now ki over k times the scalar v plus tau derivative of a over a times ki over k times another scalar v. And that equals negative I ki times psi, your favorite letter. And all of the ki's cancel. And now I can multiply through, so these two equations just simplify. Okay, so 3, in the end, we can impose that this thing psi equals minus phi, finally. But if you want to keep it around because you're talking about something that has anisotropic stress, you know what to do. Okay, so once we make that assumption, then we get the following two equations. So from the first one, we have the time derivative delta plus IKV, and that equals minus 3 times the tau derivative of phi. And then from the second equation, we get the time derivative of the scalar v. We'll multiply through everywhere by k, plus the tau derivative of a over a times the scalar v. And that thing is going to equal, I flip the sign, and I get a positive I k phi. Okay, so here are our equations. So these are the equations that govern the evolution of matter in the universe. So really here, this is pretty much only valid for the dark matter and baryons. After decoupling. And that's sufficient, right? So this is our set of equations that govern the behavior of matter. You will explore these equations in gory detail in your homework assignment. But here's where you'll start. So we have that, and we have Einstein's equation. So we can take Einstein's equation and go to Fourier space, and then we'll have the complete set of things we need to worry about. So that del squared gives me a minus k squared. And now I have plus 3 times the time derivative of a over a. And now I get a minus sign because I convert phi to psi, minus phi. And then I get a minus tau derivative of phi. And that whole thing equals negative 4 pi g Newton a squared rho bar times delta. Okay, so now we have a complete system of equations. We got 3 unknowns, phi, v, and delta, and we got 3 equations. So we can solve these equations. So point number 1. Earlier in the week, we had written down a system of equations that we're supposed to hold for a fluid that's well described by Newtonian gravity with the fudge factor that I include the expansion. And you did this tutorial on that topic. So what you'll notice is that if I define a Newtonian potential as negative phi, oh, by the way, this is one of 1,000 extremely annoying conventions in cosmological perturbation theory. So if you look in different books, there's different signs. And if you look in different books, sometimes they call this psi and the other one phi. And there's like no agreement and everyone does it differently. So just be aware there's some annoying factors in there. But anyway, with this annoying choice of convention, if I make that replacement and I neglect basically this term here and this term here. So if we neglect these time derivatives of phi and this other term, this d tau a over a times phi, then Einstein's equations reduce to the Poisson equation. And nothing happens to the velocity equation, but you'll show in your homework that this actually agrees with the Newtonian thing we wrote down. And here, if I can neglect the time derivative, I end up with the right equation for delta. And so it turns out that the condition under which I can neglect these is precisely, as you'll show in your homework, the condition that k is much, much greater than the co-moving horizon. K is much, much bigger than AH. So I'll ask you to show that in this limit, you can neglect these two terms in these equations. Okay, so in this limit, we just recover this Newtonian stuff, and we already know what happens there. So in this Newtonian limit, we know that delta grows like the scale factor, say in matter domination. Phi, we can solve for phi from the Poisson equation, so phi decays during matter domination. because if delta goes like A and rho bar goes like, or phi is frozen, sorry, if delta goes like A and rho bar goes like 1 over A cubed, then I get A squared over A squared and constant. So phi Newtonian is constant in matter domination. And you all are experts on this, so you know how to do the Newtonian theory. And now we can go back and we can answer this question about what happens on superhorizon scales, right? So now I have the full set of equations without any approximations. I can just tell you what happens. So we can send k to 0 in these equations and then try and solve them. So if we send k to 0, we get the time derivative delta equals minus 3 times the time derivative of phi. That's one equation. So from this equation, we learn immediately that delta had better be equal to minus 3 times phi plus some constant. And the other equation we have up there, so we've got the equation for the velocities. So we've got delta tau v plus d tau a over a times v equals 0. So this equation is, we can rewrite it in a slightly more illustrative way, is this. So you can see that unless that's negative, which it isn't in an expanding universe, then I get basically a decaying function. I must have a decaying function as a solution to this. Right. So peculiar velocities decay on superhorizon scales. And then finally, we can solve Einstein's equation up there for the behavior of phi. So we have 3 d tau a over a negative d tau a over a times phi minus d tau phi. And that's supposed to equal negative 4 pi g times a squared rho bar delta. And as part of your homework assignment, you will show that this equation implies that phi in a matter-dominated universe is equal to a constant plus the decaying solution. And because this equation relates phi and delta, we can actually go a little bit further. We can solve for what this constant has to be. And from that, we learn that delta has got to equal 2 phi. So that's the result of this analysis, at least in a matter-dominated universe. Okay, so we've confirmed here something that I just stated earlier. And that thing that I stated earlier was that on superhorizon scales, delta and phi just don't do anything. They're quote, frozen in. So delta and phi are frozen in on these super horizon scales. So if we had, instead of a matter-dominated universe, a radiation-dominated universe, this would still be true. But there would be a different constant out in front of phi. I think it's 3 instead of 2. That's the only difference. Okay, so that does it for matter. That's everything that we need to know about how matter behaves in linear cosmological perturbation theory with some arbitrary rho bar, right? Rho bar could be whatever. It could be a sum of fluids. It could be just matter. It could be whatever you want. So before we move on to photons, are there any questions about matter? Okay, so let's talk about photons. Why are we talking about photons? So, of course, the universe was radiation dominated. Early on. And that radiation now shows up as the cosmic microwave background radiation. And the cosmic microwave background radiation is probably the most important observational tool we have for use today in cosmology. So it's important to understand the distribution of photons, how they, quote, clump, or how they could be inhomogeneous or anisotropic in the universe. And you'll recall that when we tried to do this using our Newtonian theory, we saw that it just totally failed miserably. And the reason was that the, so from the Newtonian theory, let's just recap. We found that the density perturbations in a photon fluid, in a relativistic fluid, just undergo damped oscillations on scales k much, much less than or greater than ah. And there was a gene scale, and that gene scale was of order the horizon size. So using our Newtonian theory, we actually couldn't tell whether or not I can get lumps of photons, or what happens with, do photons undergo gravitational collapse like matter? And of course, all of that motivated talking about a fully relativistic treatment. Which is what we will do now. So I waved my hands a little bit about anisotropic stress and how the perfect fluid approximation doesn't really work for relativistic species on all scales. So I could fudge that. I could fix that a little bit by defining an energy momentum tensor that had contributions from an imperfect fluid. That would be one way to proceed. So one path to relativistic photons would be to define a T mu nu that's a perfect fluid plus some contributions of an imperfect fluid. We won't do that. We will solve instead the Boltzmann equations. Yes?
So if we have a wave number that's much larger than the horizon, that means that we have a wavelength that's really small, right?
Yeah, and that's right.
Shouldn't it oscillate? I don't understand why. Why do we have to do a relativistic treatment to that? That is true.
Yeah, so that we know from the Newtonian approximation,
yeah.
Certainly that on small enough scales, for small enough wavelengths, we just undergo these damped oscillations. And that came about because the photon fluid has pressure. And so so that gave me the oscillations, and we're an expanding universe, that gave me the damping. And then we asked, okay, well, if I make a lump of photons big enough, could I make that undergo gravitational collapse? Could I find exponentially growing and decaying solutions instead of oscillatory solutions? And you can find that, but the condition that you need is sort of out of the realm of validity of this treatment that we had done before.
Okay.
Yeah. Just to spoil the punchline, of course, photons don't undergo gravitational collapse on superhorizon scales. They just don't. Okay, so so don't use conservation of stress energy. Instead, use the Boltzmann equation. This is the probably next to Einstein's equation, the most deceptively simple-looking equation in all of physics. So the Boltzmann equation is just that the total time derivative of the distribution function is equal to a set of terms that would be zero in the absence of any collisions. So the simplest form would be that this is zero. The time derivative of the distribution function is zero. But just like Einstein's equations, this equation is hiding a lot of complicated details. It's just a simple way of writing things. So what is the distribution function, to remind you? So the distribution function is something that tells me the number density of states in phase space. So it's defined as, in general, something that could be dependent on position, momenta, and time integrated over phase space. So this is sort of the density. You can think the density of states in phase space, more or less. So this is momentum, not pressure. I wish there were more letters in the English alphabet, but when you see P for the next few lectures, it means momentum, not pressure. Okay, so that's the distribution function. Of course, you know about many distribution functions. The most common ones would be the Bose-Einstein distribution function. And for Bose-Einstein, of course, the distribution function is the energy plus the chemical potential divided by temperature minus 1. And then there's Fermi-Dirac. And Fermi-Dirac is just the same thing, plus 1. Okay, and as the name hints, this is for bosons, this is for fermions. And since we're talking about photons, we're probably going to want to use that one. So if I had a homogeneous gas of photons, then this is sort of the standard stuff from StatMech. So for photons, the energy is just equal to the magnitude of the momentum. And I could stick that into my distribution up there. And I could calculate things, for example, like the energy density. So the energy density would be some something g, which is just the number of polarization states for a fixed momentum, times an integral of the distribution function. Which in this case, we're assuming it's not a function of x, it's just a function of p. And then I could multiply this by an energy. So in this case, the energy is just p, and then integrate this over all momenta. And that would give me an energy density. And here, for photons, I think if I remember the answer right, this is like pi squared over 15 times t to the fourth power. Don't kill me if I got the numbers wrong. So you can calculate energy densities and all sorts of useful things using the distribution function. And what we're going to be interested in is not the homogeneous case, but the inhomogeneous case. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to set the chemical potential to zero. there is an interesting and important new field of cosmology where you actually don't set the chemical potential to zero. So what does this correspond to? This basically corresponds to assuming that there's no inhomogeneous injection of energy. Like, I don't dump a whole bunch of photons in one place and then make some chemical potential. So you will see in the literature these new things called spectral distortions. This amounts to basically relaxing this assumption. So you can get information about energy injection if you relax this assumption. This is in fact a new tool that people use in cosmology to look at the scales that are really small where I do inject a lot of energy. But here we're going to set that to zero. So two, we need to figure out some way of incorporating inhomogeneities into our distribution function. So in general, it could be a function of space, momenta, and time. And the way that we're going to parameterize it is to rewrite the Bose-Einstein distribution as a momenta divided by temperature times 1 plus this thing we'll call theta. And in general, theta could be a function of t, x, and p. Okay, so this is going to be our new distribution function. And you can see that all of this spatial dependence and all the extra dependence on momenta is encapsulated in this function theta. And we're going to assume, of course, that this function theta is much less than 1. So before we jump into the details, let's just state what we're after. What do we want? So I measure stuff. I mean, the reason we probably want to talk about a distribution of photons is because I'm actually sitting here collecting photons. So an interesting observable would be something like the number of photons that I collect if I look in a certain direction on the sky, for example. And I'm not anywhere. I'm not at an arbitrary position at an arbitrary time. So really what I want is something like the differential number of photons that I collect here and now, just right here in this room. And so we can compute this differential number of things that I collect here and now by taking an integral. So I can take this distribution function, which told me about stuff that was happening everywhere at all momenta at all times. I can make this easy, so I don't have any integral over t in the distribution of the in the definition of the number density. So I could just look now by looking at this at a particular time. And to evaluate this here, I can just integrate d cubed x over my position here. So I'll just put a delta function here. And let's just leave the momenta alone for now. OK, so that's easy. I get f evaluated at x here. And I've got this integral now, this differential left over momenta. And we can rewrite that differential over momenta as a magnitude and an angle. Okay, so I'm sitting here, so I'm really looking at momenta that are defined with respect to my fixed reference frame. And so we can rewrite this as fx here, p t now times b p squared. P squared dp times the differential angle. And so I can get the differential number per unit solid angle per unit momentum. And that is just given by this distribution function times p squared over 2 pi cubed. And I can turn this number into an energy. So I know that the energy of a photon is just its momenta. So I can trade this for an energy just by multiplying by a p everywhere. OK, so here is the differential number, or the differential energy in photons that I would measure as a function of the direction that I say look on the sky. And as a function of their momentum, or equivalently of their energy.
So is p your momentum or theirs?
P is the momentum of the photons. So this distribution function is telling me about how the photons are distributed in phase space. So I'm just sitting still at some position right here. And this, if we substitute in the Bose-Einstein distribution, so we can rewrite this as e to the minus, or e to the p over t, 1 plus theta minus 1. If theta were 0, you would immediately recognize this as a black body distribution. So if theta is 0, this would just be a black body. And if theta was a function only of the direction of the momenta and not the momenta itself, then it wouldn't change the spectrum. It wouldn't change the fact that I have a black body spectrum. But it would just show up as a modulation of the direction. So if theta is only a function of p hat, or in other words, if theta is only a function of the solid angle, or the place that I look on the sky, then this thing here just looks like a modulation of the temperature, right? So then theta would tell me how the temperature, I'd still have a black body spectrum everywhere I looked, but it would tell me how the temperature changed as a function of my viewing angle. So it would say that I have a different temperature. So this would be a black body with an observation angle dependent temperature. Okay? And that would just be parameterized by this thing theta. If theta was a function of the momenta itself, then you can see here I'd screw up my black body spectrum. So then I would have actually a different dependence on momentum in different directions on the sky. So here I'd have distorted black body with a sort of anisotropic distortion. And so these are the three possibilities, basically, right? So if I evaluate things here and now, then theta is a function of t here, x now, and in general, the momentum. Okay. And you can see that I have these three possibilities. Either it's 0, and I get a black body. It's only dependent on the direction of the momentum, in which case I get a black body with an anisotropic temperature. Or it can really be a function of the momenta itself, in which case I get some crazy anisotropic distribution that looks nothing like a black body, possibly. Of course, well, you can tell me the answer, because you all know that the CMB is the universe's most perfect black body, and we always draw plots of the CMB with anisotropic temperature, right? So this is what it means. Basically, it's the assumption that this thing theta is a function only of the direction of momenta. Okay, and why that's true? So photons interact with electrons. And Compton scattering doesn't actually change the momentum of the photons very much. So if I scatter photons off of electrons, this doesn't change the magnitude of P very much. So that's actually a good approximation. All right, so that's awesome. I'm totally right on time. That was the last thing I had written in my notes. So any questions before we leave it for today?
So yep. That's why the CM, like W map, that's why it's a map of the temperature, as opposed to really we're collecting photons with a certain amount of energy, but we map that to temperature because of this assumption? Or
exactly. Yeah, exactly. So the thing you're actually probing, say, with WMAP would be this function theta evaluated at a given position.
Right.
So this piece of the distribution function evaluated at a given position. That's right.
So what would it look like if it was theta at P and not P at?
In general, arbitrary, right? I mean, so if it's an arbitrary function of P, then this distribution would look nothing like a black body spectrum. So it would just be some, I'd look in one place, I'd collect a whole bunch of photons, and I'd map their distribution as a function of momentum, and it would look something that's totally not like a black body. And then I'd look in the other part of the sky, and I'd do the same thing. I'd map the distribution by collecting a whole bunch of photons in different energy bins and draw the distribution function. And again, it would look nothing like a black body and totally different. So, you know, really it would just be arbitrary. And then it wouldn't make any sense whatsoever to draw a map, a temperature map, right? Because in no sense could I really define a temperature. So as long as this is true, then I always get, you know, if I look in one place on the sky, we'll call it theta 1, phi 1, and I look at this distribution in energy, you know, I'll get a black body with a peak at a certain point in P that tells me about the temperature, and that'll be the temperature at one place. And then, oh, I have colored chalk. And then if I look at a different place, you know, I'd get a black body spectrum, but now it would just be at a different, the peak would be at a different position. So if I only have things as a function of p hat, then my distribution function is always just a black body with a shifting peak position. But in your case, I'd get, you know, in one part of the sky, I'd get something that looks like this. I don't know, that looks an awful lot like the CMB. I don't know why I do that. And then in another place in the sky, I'd get something that looks like this. And, you know, it would just be crazy. And there's no way I could parameterize that by one number, a temperature.
And presumably the observational evidence is very, very, very much so strongly in favor of this. Like the black bodiness
yes.
of the CMB is extraordinary, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you could do that by, so Kobe FIRAS instrument is the first instrument that measured the black body spectrum of the CMB. And they just took the whole sky and averaged it.
Okay.
So that's like the average black body, but it's really darn close to a black body.
Uh-huh.
Right? So you could do another experiment, say, where you had, you pick one patch of the sky and you measure the spectrum, and then you pick a different patch of the sky and you measure the spectrum and you compare them. I mean, that's effectively what we're doing when we make these temperature maps, but you could do it like with a lot more frequency resolution and actually build the black body spectrum. And then what you would see is precisely this effect that it would be basically a black body with a different peak. However, in reality, you'd find these small deviations from a perfect black body. And that's due to two things. First of all, this statement is not 100% true. It does change the momentum by a little bit when you scatter. And the second thing is that we neglected the chemical potential in step one. And if that's non-zero, then that causes a distortion of the black body spectrum. And so you can use that by measuring the frequency in different parts of the sky. You could measure these distortions in the spectrum, and you could learn something about energy deposition at early times. And that's this business of spectral distortions, which you might see talks advertised at PI for, or hear about it somewhere. But that's what that's all about.
So yeah. Can you just explain quickly again why the fact that scattering doesn't change momentum very much implies that you'll have some independent, the your theta function will be independent of the magnitude of your momentum vector?
So if I have thermal equilibrium,
yeah.
Then my photons are going to have this distribution, right? Now I say that no, they're interacting too, right? And they're interacting with this with the electrons, right? So in principle, the electrons could steal energy from your photon bath.
Oh, depending on where you are.
Yeah,
okay,
depending on where I am. So that would correspond to actually changing the magnitude of the momenta. But in fact, that doesn't happen. More or less, it's like, you know, the billiard balls where you just come in and you scatter off the electron and you change directions, but you don't actually change energy. Any other questions? Okay, then see you Monday and good luck with the homework.